I'm Francis Lamb, and this is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show for curious cooks and eaters. Now, my passport really doesn't get the workout I wish it would. I mean, I'm grateful, seriously, that I get to roam around in our beautiful country, but there's really nothing quite like going out there, right? Going out somewhere that's totally different from where you live, where you might not know the language or the culture or the food, and you just let the enormity of the world wash over you, right? And you remind yourself that there are a zillion different ways to live a life on this planet. And you could feel the humility and welcome of being a guest. You know, Tony Bourdain once said that the more I travel, the less I know. And isn't that literally what having a sense of wonder is all about? This week, we are all about the life-changing magic of getting out of town. Through the Black Sea, to Haiti, to France, and more. And our first stop is Thailand. Andy Ricker, the chef owner of Pok Pok in Portland, has spent over 30 years traveling and cooking in Thailand, and the last 15, sharing what he's learned to cook there with the rest of the world. He's got a new book out called Pok Pok Noodles, and Sally Swift caught up with him to talk about carbs, yes, but also about the traveling life in Thailand. Have a listen.
Andy Ricker, so nice to have you in our hemisphere.
It's great to be in this hemisphere.
So I want to talk to you about Thailand, obviously, because you have been there for a really, really long time. You started visiting in the 80s, right?
Yeah, the first time, I believe, was 1985. I'd have to look back three passports back to figure it out, but I think it was 85.
And how has it changed in these years?
I think that Thailand has gotten a lot more cosmopolitan. Even in the rural areas, that you know, they're connected and they're aware. The cities have gotten quite cosmopolitan. The Bangkok feels like an international city. I mean, the first time I went there, there wasn't that presence of other folks from other countries walking around. It was very, very insular. The Thai folks tend to be somewhat, I don't know if xenophobic is the right word, but they definitely feel that Thailand is for Thai people, mostly, and it's fine to come and visit. So up until fairly recently, it wasn't really encouraged to come and stay.
Right.
But that seems to be changing. There's a lot more, and I think that comes down to the fact that a lot of Thai people have traveled at this point, and especially, you know, with the rise of the middle class there. You know, you'll be in Bangkok at a restaurant, and there'll be folks from India, and folks from Denmark, and folks from Niger, folks from all over the place, America, Israel. And while there used to be folks coming from those places, there weren't that many that were just living, you know,
right,
like raising families and working and stuff like that, owning businesses.
If someone were to ask you, someone who's never been to Thailand before, where would you send them?
The first thing I do is ask a question of them. I say, what is it that you want? You know, because Thailand can be whatever you want it to be. You can go and spend, you know, you can have a fantastic time, go to the beach and just have a beach holiday. Or you can go into the mountains and go hiking into national parks. Or you could go up a river trip. Or you could be in a big city or a small town. It just really kind of depends on what you're into. And once I have that kind of information, I just tell them, go, pick a place to start, and then don't make too many plans.
Right.
You know, the good thing about traveling is that you meet people along the way, right? And often you'll arrive somewhere thinking you want to go somewhere, and somebody will say, hey, but we're going to this place, and we've heard it's really great. Here's the pictures. My friend was just there. It's amazing.
Right.
Just as a matter of principle, I like to be flexible when I travel.
Mm-hmm. I do want to talk about food because I want to talk about street food with you, because I think that you are one of the people in the United States that have really opened our eyes to what street food is in Asia. What was that like for you when you discovered that scene there? Was your mind blown? It seems just to be so enormous and complicated and wonderful.
So the first time I went to Thailand, like so many other travelers, I didn't have any language skills. And I mean, this is back in the 80s,
right,
for the first time. And the infrastructure there wasn't super. So there wasn't a lot of places where there was a sign on the outside saying, here's what we have in this restaurant, or come in here to eat this particular dish. But what you could do is you could walk down the street and you could see the food being made on the side of the street. And that made it easy because you could just say, that looks good to me. And just kind of, you know, without being able to speak the language, you just pointed a bowl and say, I'll have that.
Right.
And you could, and it was easy to get. And because I grew up in the United States where street food back then was non-existent, like the odd taco truck or something like that. So I think that was the thing that really got me, was and why I was so interested in that food initially, was because it was accessible.
and exciting.
It was new to me, and because at the time in America didn't really get its big push of Thai immigration until the late 80s. So, most of Thai food was really mysterious to me. And to be honest with you, the stuff that was really exciting to me back then is fairly mundane at this point because there's so much more interesting stuff off the street.
I want to talk about noodles because you say something in the book that I love about noodles being this great entry level for people heading to Thailand. Where does that tradition come from?
The noodles on the street? Yeah. It mostly comes from Chinese immigrants coming to Thailand in various different waves over the last couple hundred years. But it didn't really hit its stride until probably like 80 years ago, something like that. The whole idea of noodle carts on the street mm-hmm. is something that is relatively recent. It doesn't go back 500 years. Thailand is an agrarian society, or was, and people typically ate at home. And, the big cities were mostly places of government and commerce, and there wasn't a large press of people working like there are now that needed a quick lunch.
Right.
So, as the cities grew, that's when street food really took off.
Is there an indigenous Thai noodle? Is there something that is particularly theirs?
So there's one noodle that we think is the indigenous noodle, and that's Khnom Chin, and that's a fresh rice vermicelli noodle. And initially it was made in the royal courts because the amount of work it took was quite intense. You got to mill the rice flour, and then you have to make a dough, and you let the dough ferment, and then you pound it with a mortar and pestle, giant wooden mortar and pestle, like two people pounding at it for hours.
Wow.
To make it into this kind of more elastic texture. And then it's, mixed with water, and it forms kind of a slurry. In the old days, they would push it through kind of a cylindrical brass cup with a plunger with holes in the bottom, and hand press these things into a vat of boiling water. But in order to make, a substantial amount of this stuff, it took a lot of labor.
And thin noodles. Are they very thin?
They're very thin, yeah. They're quite thin. They're like, I call them rice vermicelli because it's the closest thing.
Okay,
like
that's
angel
what we can
sort of
find
thing.
Here is rice vermicelli. And is that different than, which I would say vermicelli, of course, I'm sorry. But and are rice stick noodles close to them as well?
Okay, so now we get into the naming regimens here.
This was going to be a slippery slope.
Well, when J.J. Good and I were writing this book, we would go back and forth because, J.J. is a stickler and he wants to make sure that the information that we put in the book is accurate and people can follow it. And I just say, rice vermicelli or vermicelli. And he would say, yeah, but is it rice stick? And I'd say, show me the package. And he'd show me a package and I'd say, no, that's not it.
Okay.
And he'd show me something else. And I'd go, okay, well... And I'd show him a package. This is what it is. And sometimes it says bun on the outside if it's Vietnamese, B-U-N. Other times it says rice stick. Sometimes it says vermicelli. Sometimes it says many different things. So what we've come down to is trying to find the way it's most commonly sold here. And it's most commonly sold as guangji noodles or bun, Vietnamese. And it's dry and it looks like a very thin white piece of spaghetti, but the problem is it comes in different thicknesses.
Right.
What we look for is the fine or extra fine rice vermicelli or rice stick.
Is there a brand you like?
Three Ladies brand, I think, is a good one.
I always love these names.
Yeah.
Okay, I want to talk to you in general about cooking Asian noodles because I think that we don't really understand what the proper technique is. Do you soak it? Does it go in boiling water? Do you salt the water? What's protocol on Asian noodles?
Well, it depends on the kind of noodles.
Yeah.
There's some that you don't cook at all till you actually assemble the dish. And there's others that you have to soak in advance. There's others that you just take from the state they're in when you buy them and boil them and throw them into stuff. So it really depends. So for instance, I'll give you a couple of examples. Glass noodles or bean thread noodles or cellophane noodles. Here in the West, they always come dry and they're in like a little bundle. And you have to soak those for quite some time in hot water before you cook them. Or else they don't saturate. They don't get all the water that they need soaked into them to become a noodle that's edible or that tastes good.
So you'd soak them and then boil them?
Yes. So you soak them until they're pliable, probably about 20 or 30 minutes in quite warm or hot tap water.
Right.
And then you boil them briefly before you eat them.
And salted water? Not salted water?
Typically not salted water. Most of the time people don't salt the water before they do noodles. But there's other noodles. So for instance, senyai, kwetiau senyai, which is fresh wide rice noodles, which you can buy in Chinese markets, in Asian, Southeast Asian markets. And those are made in a factory, but they don't dry them. They make them and they wrap them in packets and send them to the market. And the best ones, they don't refrigerate them. But that only happens in the markets where they make the noodles. So, for instance, right. in LA, you can get really fresh, warm, beautiful rice, you know, flat, wide rice noodles in the morning because they've just been delivered from the San Gabriel Valley to all the stores around the city. But in Portland, we don't have that. So they put them in refrigerator trucks and carry them up. So by the time you get them up there, they're like a hard glob of stuck together noodle. That type of noodle, typically for, say, pet siu or something, a stir-fried noodle, you would take it directly out of the package and just throw it into the pan and start frying it. Or you might throw it into a noodle basket and dip it in hot water just to heat it up right before you put it in soup.
I want to ask you about instant ramen because I am quite fascinated to see that you had a couple recipes in the book about them. What is their role in Thailand?
So ramen in Thailand is, you know, it's kind of like the ubiquitous snack for students. And once you gain a taste for
them,
it
kind of
sticks around.
I mean, it's everywhere.
Well, everywhere, yeah. Thais are really obsessed, and they're obsessed with one particular brand called Mama. And they're so obsessed with it that basically it's kind of like we call a tissue Kleenex,
oh,
right?
Really?
So it's Mama is ramen. You can eat it raw with the flavor packet like sprinkled on it
like
as a snack.
Like bite the chunk, the box?
You just eat the plastic and everything. They come in little plastic containers. You pull out the brick and you can kind of break it up and eat it like a snack.
Right.
Or you can eat it the way it says to eat it on the package.
Right.
You also see it around the country at noodle stalls as an option for noodles. Like typically you'll go to a noodle soup stall and they'll say, what kind of noodle do you want with your soup? Do you want thin rice noodles, wide rice noodles? Do you want really, really, really fine rice noodles? Do you want bummy or wheat noodles? Or you want wunsen, which is the glass noodle? But they often have mama as an option as well. So you can get instant ramen in your boat noodles if you want.
That is amazing to
me.
How fun. It's a worldwide thing. Okay, my last question for you once and for all. Chopsticks or no chopsticks in Thailand?
Chopsticks in Thailand for noodles, for sure, and for Chinese food and Japanese food. But typically, historically, Thai people ate food with their hands and with a spoon and fork. Spoon and fork was more of a recent thing, in the last 150 years or so. Kind of the spoon to put the food in your mouth, fork to push the food onto the spoon. But, you know, there's a lot of Chinese folks that live in Thailand, and the influence there is very, very strong. So you see it at noodle shops. You see it at Chinese restaurants. And more recently, a lot of Japanese restaurants come through, so you see it there, too.
Okay, it's the last word from you, Andy Ricker. Thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you very much.
Andy Ricker is the author of Pok Pok Noodles. You can find his recipe for Yam Mama, or instant ramen noodle salad, at splendidtable.org. And it is an awesome dish, especially if you don't think you're a fan of instant noodles. Coming up, the writer Caroline Eden on her travels around the Black Sea, and the recipes that Melissa Clark brings back from her journeys. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is The Splendid Table from APM. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is the show for curious cooks and eaters. Is there any place you've never been but you're still kind of obsessed with? I mean, for me, I have wanted to go to Ulaanbaatar ever since a buddy of mine in college was getting rid of his stuff and I inherited his Lonely Planet travel guide to Mongolia. And I've been almost weirdly desperate to see Newfoundland after reading The Shipping News by Annie Proulx, like one of my all-time favorite books. But journalist Caroline Eden fell in love with the Black Sea because of a car accident during a trip to Turkey. She was safe. Her bus pulled out of the way, but after that scary moment, she looked out the window, and it was as if the sea just appeared to her. It captured her. She decided to learn about the Black Sea by traveling around it, to traverse Europe and Asia and see what it means when you put all of these very old cultures along the same body of water. So hi, Caroline.
Hi, Francis.
Thanks so much for joining us. I'm excited to talk with you about your book. It's so beautiful.
Thank you very much for having me on.
So I have never thought to define a region through a body of water. I think it's so interesting that that's the conceit of your book. But, you know, the Black Sea is huge, and you traveled along it all the way from Ukraine to eastern Turkey, and those are super different places. Is there something that connects the cuisines and the cultures of the Black Sea?
Well, that was what I wanted to find out. So I had several questions in mind when I started to do the research and the travel. And I wanted to find out what was left of the historic trade routes, what lies hidden, And how can history books tell us that it's the birthplace of barbarism, yet the sea that welcomes strangers? And I knew it was a great place of migration. And with migration often comes very interesting food stories.
Yeah. And what did you see? Like, how did the food... Well, at least from the perspective of your journey from Odessa all the way to Trabzon in eastern Turkey, how did you see the food change? Could you sense it evolving in some like particular way?
It was an amazing couple of journeys. I did two long trips of 6 weeks each, and then I did some sort of individual trips to Istanbul and Odessa. And the food culture was much richer than I first imagined when I set out. Mm. Odessa has got Italian and Jewish cuisines there, which I hadn't expected. Istanbul, a city I love that I visit regularly, for me is the world's greatest kitchen. And sure. I looked at that from a Black Sea perspective only. And then as we sort of continue through to Trabzon, the Black Sea region of Turkey, quite unexplored in food writing, is completely different to the rest of Turkey. So buttery, smoky, different flavours, different ingredients, amazing produce, and really interesting historical stories to do with food as well. So really, really an incredible region full of different cultures.
Yeah. So what were some of the places that really surprised you on this journey, and what did they taste like?
So to start in Odessa, one of the most interesting things is the Italian connection. Mm. So I have a recipe in the book for Italian street polpette, and that's because Italians were the first restaurateurs in Odessa.
Really?
One of the founders of the city. Yeah, so it's founded in 1794 by someone from Naples, actually, who was appointed by Catherine the Great to kind of seize the Tartar-run fort that was there. So 1794, it becomes a city, and some people followed him. Italians followed Deribas, who was one of the founders, and other people. This is a region that was sort of run by Italian merchant colonizers, the Genoese, the Venetians. They were running the Black Sea trading ports, so it's always been an Italian region. And Italian used to be heard on the streets of Odessa when it was first founded, and signposts would be in Russian and in Italian.
That's
and this
so
was fascinating, and I didn't know this until I got there. Yeah, Alexander Pushkin, when he was there in Odessa in the 1820s, heard Italian spoken on the streets and writes about that, and stayed in a hotel on Italian Street.
And did the cuisines... I mean, obviously, when we talk about cuisines being the result of, you know, migration of people, the movement of people, often it's also with a certain level of conflict. And, you know, and
yes.
You know, if just hungry people tend to ignore that part, but... was there a sense that there was a commingling of, you know, what could be seen as Italian foods versus what could be seen as more traditional Ukrainian foods?
Definitely. I mean, I think you can go to most cities in the world and there's going to be an Italian restaurant, but they have
sure.
held on to this sort of Italian culture, and people know about it. You know, it used to be taught in schools Italian back in the day when it was first founded, and it was the lingua franca of the commercial harbour, as it was in Constantinople, which is now obviously Istanbul, across the Black Sea. So that history is very much part of the Odessan history. And one of the most interesting things I have to tell you was when I was researching, all these tales of shipwrecks started to be published in the newspapers here in the UK. A British and Bulgarian archaeological team started to explore the Black Sea 2,000 metres below. And down there, they uncovered 40 or more shipwrecks, some of them completely wow. preserved, because the Black Sea, 90% of it doesn't have oxygen. It's almost a dead sea. It's just the 10% on the top that has
wow.
the fish, which is perfect for preserving. And they found ships 2,400 years old from the Venetian times, from Roman shipwrecks. They found Cossack assault vessels. And the most amazing one, as far as we're concerned with food, was a 2,400-year-old ship which had clay jars still within it, and one of them still had diced-up fish steaks intact. So,
oh, wow.
you know, it's so amazing. It's not just the countries around the Black Sea that's interesting from a food and trade and sort of cultural perspective. It's what's under the waves as well.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. What other places surprised you, and like dishes or elements of the cuisine surprised you?
I was really fascinated by the Turkish tea culture. So I visit Istanbul regularly, and I always drink a lot of tea when I'm there because, you know, it's fantastic.
Sure.
It comes in the little, you know, tulip shapes, the glass cups, and it's delicious and refreshing. And I didn't really know very much about the Turkish tea industry, but it was somewhere I stopped on my travels in the very far northeast of Turkey, close to a city called Rize, 50 miles east of Trabzon, so almost, you know, you're almost in Georgia when you're up there. And there's an interesting climate there. It's quite monsoonal and wet and humid. So the heat sort of rises in Central Asia and then it cools on the Black Sea. And this is ideal for tea growing. And what I saw when I arrived there are hills covered in 100 different shades of green, curvy, rolling down to the Black Sea and, you know, tea plantations like you visualize with somewhere like Sri Lanka. I didn't know that this existed there. And it's now the fifth largest tea region in the world. Yeah. After India, China, I think Sri Lanka and Kenya. And it began in the 1920s and they've been harvesting tea since in that region. And it's supremely delicious. It's very clean tasting and sort of amber, dark red amber color. And I've heard, I don't know if this is true, that the Turks will say when it's ready, it's red as rabbit's blood. That's the colour of the tea. That sort of
That's really dark red description.
Colour. Yeah, right. It's lovely to drink it there amongst the tea plantations and to see it being picked. A lot of Georgians were working there when we were there against it, like modern trade. The ones we spoke to said it was very hard to make a living in Georgia, and so they'd come there to work in the tea plantations of Turkey. But yeah, that was really interesting. That surprised me.
Yeah. And is there so as you mentioned in Istanbul, there's, you know, tea is served almost at any point in the day.
Right.
Is there a particular tea drinking tradition there in Eastern Turkey too? Is it served with food?
I think there's maybe just more of it. I mean, because you're there in tea country, you know, Turks consume the most tea in the world per capita. I think the Irish are second. So Turks really are big tea drinkers.
We're the Chinese.
And we say 10 cups a day. No, I think the Turks are number one. And, you know, seven or eight glasses in a sitting is not unusual. And, you know, it's just fascinating, the history of tea in Turkey, because it's a relatively new story. And, you know, the first crop was in 1939. So, yeah.
Right. So in this whole journey from Odessa all the way to Trabzon, do you have a memory of the most delicious thing that you ate the entire time?
I do. And it was in Istanbul, predictably, probably. But so I was headed to Trabzon and I'm in Istanbul and I heard that there was a cultural center where people from Trabzon go in Istanbul and dance and play cards and there's food served there. So I went there with someone who was helping me with translation because I don't speak Turkish. And we sat with a lady and she served us Black Sea börek. So lots of layers of phyllo and then inside rice, chard, which is very popular in the Black Sea region of Turkey, sultanas and pine nuts. Super simple, but so delicious. And I think is my favorite because I make it a lot at home still now.
Yeah. And if someone were to, I doubt many people would have the adventure in them to trace your entire journey. But as you were traveling through these very different regions, did you rely on fixers? Like if you were a traveler to these places, obviously Istanbul is truly one of the great cosmopolitan global cities. So, you know, tourists go there all the time. But if you were going to some of these other places, even like in Odessa, would you have any advice for travelers?
I know a couple of people who've done the journey based on the book,
really?
Actually, which I love. It totally makes everything worthwhile.
I mean,
I love, I love to hear that. The only difficult part is getting from Odessa to Constanta in Romania. That is a really long overnight bus ride. It's not easy. There's no easy flight. There's no train. It's a bus and it's fine, but it's long. The rest of it, I don't think it's a difficult journey. We took a taxi for part of the way. We took buses. I traveled with my husband for quite large sections of the trip. Turkey is very well set up with an excellent bus network along the Black Sea. Very comfortable buses. I don't think it's not a difficult region to travel in. You need to have a slight sense of adventure because the Turkish Black Sea region is not like the south. They don't get many tourists. And it's a little bit conservative, but that's not to say it's not friendly. It's very friendly. Almost more so because there's not much tourism there. And Odessa's fine. It's a lot of young people there speak English. Russians, you hear Russian mainly there, actually more than Ukrainian spoken. So if you speak Russian, that comes in really useful. And Bulgaria is a lot of holiday resorts are along the Black Sea where Brits go on holiday, but also very easy to get off the beaten track there. So I think it's a wonderful region to travel in, to skirt the coast that way.
Very lovely. Well, thank you so much for making the journey and reporting back for us.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you.
Caroline Eden is the author of Black Sea, Dispatches and Recipes Through Darkness and Light. And if you go to splendidtable.org, you can find that recipe she talked about for Black Sea Borek. It's a crispy phyllo pie filled with greens, raisins, and pine nuts. Some people go on their travels and bring back trinkets or clothes, or if you're like me, a weird amount of jams. But Melissa Clark brings home ideas for recipes. Whether for the New York Times or her own cookbooks, Melissa is one of our greatest recipe writers, and we wanted some of the stories behind her inspirations. Hey, Melissa.
Hey, Francis.
Great to have you here.
Great to be here.
You are a native New Yorker, but as far as I can remember, you've had like a real thing for French food professionally.
That is true. I grew up in Brooklyn, and my family spent every single summer, every August, in France. We house exchanged before house exchanging became a thing. We would get this actual physical book. This was before the internet. Imagine, take your mind back.
Okay.
Just remember the days when you would actually have to write handwritten or hand typed, I guess we would type them, letters on blue onion skin mailers.
Uh-huh.
And we would mail them to there'd be this book that would list all of the people who are interested in exchanging their house. And we would just send letters back and forth. And there was no Google. There was no way to check up on these people. And you just blindly left your house and went to their house. But for me, what that meant was I went to their kitchens and I learned how to cook in France.
As a kid.
Well, because my parents, both my parents worked. They're both psychiatrists. And so they had August off because back in the day, psychiatrists took the whole month of August. And so they were really busy and they didn't do a lot of cooking, especially with me during the regular year.
Mm.
But in the summer, we'd go to France and we would cook together as a family. And so I really, you know, people, French chefs say, I learned how to cook at my grandmother's knee. And I kind of learned how to cook at my parents' knees in France. And we weren't cooking exactly French food. We weren't cooking, I don't even know what New York food is. We were cooking this crazy hybrid, and it was very spur of the moment, and it was very inspired by what we could find at the markets and what we were eating in the restaurants. And that is absolutely the foundation of the way I cook today.
Oh, no kidding. And so do you have like specific food memories from when you were a girl, like being in this new, wonderful, weird place?
Yeah, because every summer there was something new. You know, I mean, I remember not wanting to eat frog's legs for a really, really, really long time, you know, and then I remember the moment where I was like, huh, that smells kind of garlicky and kind of good. I guess I was a teenager at that point. And, you know, so I remember that first bite. And I remember, you know, my mother would, they lied to me all the time. My mother would say, here, have some steak, you know, neglecting to mention that it was actually horse steak or, you know, rabbit was chicken. You know, I mean, they just totally lied. And so which I forgive them for. Although I do tell my daughter the truth. But, I tried a lot of things, and it was always so exciting. But I also remember the moments of choice when I got to choose what I was going to try. Like the moment I first had a snail, right? So you've got the escargot. You're in France. You've got that garlic butter, and it's all green. And you, as a kid, you take your baguette, you stick it in the butter, but you do not touch the snails because, ew, right? And I just, you know, would love that snail butter so much. And I remember taking my fork and finally tasting a snail. And I was like, wow, this is really good. It's earthy. It kind of tastes like mushrooms.
Mm-hmm,
and
mm-hmm.
So take that memory and fast forward 40 years. And now I take snail butter and I take shrimp and mushrooms and I make a dish because really snails sort of taste like shrimp crossed with mushrooms, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And so this stuff stays with me and it's stuff that I still, like those memories still influence how I cook.
Oh, right on. What's another recipe you came up with from those memories?
From France, I remember, you know, being a little kid, and this is actually more, I barely remember eating this, but I remember the physicality of making this. So we'd always take sandwiches to the beach. And in France, there's a type of sandwich called a pan bagnat. And it is basically it's a tuna fish salad sandwich, except that instead of mayonnaise, you had the Provençal flavors of tomatoes and olives and capers and tons of olive oil.
That sounds great.
And in restaurants, what they do is they weight these sandwiches down. You know, they make the sandwiches, you take a big country loaf, or you could use a baguette, you'd almost hollow out the middle, and you'd stuff it full of tuna and, you know, all those flavors I just mentioned, and then you'd flatten it out with a weight. But if you are my parents and you have two small children, you make them sit on the sandwich. So I just remember being a little kid and sort of like sitting on this big, you know, it was a giant loaf of bread. And I was sitting there in my bathing suit, really wanting to go to the beach. Like, can we go now? No, you got to sit on the sandwich.
You're making lunch, honey.
Exactly.
Keep sitting.
And it was well wrapped. I mean, we wrapped it in many layers of foil, so it was definitely protected. But it was just this funny memory. It was like this cushion, you know, this tuna fish cushion.
Yeah.
And so this is something that I also, you know, I took this memory and I love to make a pan bagnat. And when my daughter was young, I could get her to sit on the sandwich. Especially when she was like 3 and 4. Now she's almost 11 and she looks at me and she rolls her eyes. I'm like, okay, fine. And I take a big frying pan and I fill it with cans.
I mean, to be fair, an 11-year-old, like, it doesn't matter what you do, like, the eyes are going to roll.
The eyes are going to roll, right. Yeah, no, I think I could probably bribe her to sit on the sandwich, but, you know, I mean, but it's this funny tradition of physically, you know, helping make the food before I could cook.
I'm feeling almost
a little bit proud of that.
Yeah, for sure. So now you can cook very well. As an adult, though, when you're traveling, are you actively looking for recipes, or are you just kind of, like, do your thing and then let the inspiration hit you?
Both. I always actively, you know, I actively look for recipes. I actively look for flavor combinations I haven't seen before.
Mm-hmm.
So more so than asking someone, oh, how do I make that dish? You know, especially when I'm traveling, like when I was in India, you know, it was hard to communicate because, you know, I didn't speak the language and often I was with a group, so it was hard to talk to the actual cook and get the recipe, but the flavors stayed with me.
Okay.
And when I came back, I just craved spices in this intense way that if I'm going to cook with spices, I'm probably not going to cook with as many spices as I tasted in India. So it pushed me in that direction. And I was combining them in ways that I hadn't done before. So I'll look for those flavor combinations.
Okay.
There was this one dish that I remember that, so I had just gotten back. I went to India last fall and I was craving spices and I wasn't just craving them in Indian food. I was craving them in everything, like, for example, skillet pasta with like a cheesy skillet pasta,
okay.
You know, something where normally I would skew Italian. I'd get my tomato sauce and my cheese. It's like, nope. I need spices. So I added a ton of spices. I added, you know, cumin and I added turmeric and garam masala. And I created this really spicy skillet pasta. And it wasn't Indian food and it wasn't a normal, you know, for me, a usual skillet pasta, Italian. It was this weird hybrid, and I put cheddar cheese all over the top and onions in there, and it was absolutely delicious.
That sounds
good. It was really good, but it wasn't, I mean, it was just this, it was this trying to recapture this memory, but it wasn't even something I ate. It was just these scents and these fragrances of spices that I needed. I felt like I needed them.
Yeah, like it didn't have to be literal, right? It was impressionistic.
Exactly.
Oh, what is this like feeling I felt?
Yeah, it really is. Or the things that I smelled, you know, I wanted to be back there. I loved it so much. I wanted to be back there. And since I couldn't get back there, I had to cook my way to a state of being.
Right on. I'll try to think about that the next time I'm like at home, like just trying to like bake an eggplant parmesan for my kid and be like cooking my way to a state of being. She's like, Daddy, when's eggplant?
I'm hungry.
Yeah. Thanks for coming in, Melissa.
Thank you.
Melissa Clark is the author of Dinner, Changing the Game. Get your 4-year-old ready, or borrow one, because Melissa left us with a recipe for that squashable pan bagnat. Find it at splendidtable.org. Coming up, Oakland chef Sarah Kiernan talking about her life-changing trips to Haiti. And the time has come to get thee to Milwaukee. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is The Splendid Table from APM. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is the show for curious cooks and eaters.
I have eaten now at Miss Ollie's, your restaurant, I don't know, 6 or 7 times?
Mm-hmm.
And I gotta say, if your restaurant was a record, if it was an album, it would just be like wall-to-wall hits. It's just all singles. Like, I've never had a dud dish.
That's our contributor, Ali Bouzard. And one of the many things I love about Ali is that he is a literal doctor of food science. And he comes up with ideas for chefs for 3 Michelin star restaurants. But at his heart, he's just happy to be a fan of people. And he was talking to the chef Sarah Kiernan of Miss Ollie's, a Caribbean restaurant in Oakland. Sarah's from London, her family's from Barbados, but lately she's felt more and more at home in her travels to Haiti. Now, Haiti is a seriously maligned place. right? It's basically only ever talked about in American media as a disaster site or like it's some fantasy horror movie come to life. But Ali and Sarah talked about what inspires her there as a chef and a person. And their conversation is really worth a listen.
You seem to just kind of move really fluidly around different Caribbean influences. And I don't know, it just seems like you are very comfortable borrowing and sharing food that stems from ideas all around the Caribbean. And I was just curious, is there something about the Caribbean as a geographic location where there's all this trade and there's all this intermingling that makes people a little bit less stodgy about what region and who claims ownership to what technique or what kind of dish?
I like what you just said, stodgy, because it's I think if you look at the Caribbean, it's not many places. We really come from one place, mm-hmm. which is the motherland, Africa. And so when you break that up and the diaspora, things will change and things will look different. And you can say, oh, I'm from Barbados, or my mother's from Antigua, or my father's from this place, blah, blah, blah. We really still stem from one particular place. Mm-hmm. And we've been taken from that place and we've been spread throughout the world. And we use whatever we have at hand. So for me, I think that translates being comfortable in the sense that I'm not afraid to use what's on hand and make it work.
Mm-hmm.
And that the way I was taught to cook wasn't a set of rules, but it was more about being fluid and being comfortable with just putting something together and making it work.
Yeah. So you spent a lot of time in Haiti over the past couple of years.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that you took away from those visits was becoming more familiar with Haitian voodoo.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, you've been brought into this community and this religion. Can you talk about just how that came about?
It was a New Year's resolution.
Really?
I would say, yeah. 2 years ago, I was with my partner and some friends, and we were sort of looking into 2018. And I said, I'm going to Haiti. Mm-hmm. And I didn't know immediately what was going to happen. But I knew I had to make that journey. And as soon as I announced that and put that out into the world, everything fell into place. A friend of mine who I'd not seen in a couple of years, who was from Haiti, he walked back into my life. He said he was going to Haiti at the same time that I was, and I went with him, and everything unfolded from there. And making a resolution of going to Haiti for a vacation for 2 weeks turned into me finding out my ancestral rights, who I am as a person in terms of a chef, who I am spiritually, who my forefathers were, where they came from, and what my purpose is in life.
Mm-hmm.
And that keeps changing every day from this trip that I took to Haiti.
That's amazing.
I'm in this place right now that I'm following a path that was ancestrally handed to me.
Mm.
And it's not just about having a restaurant and feeding people. It's about shifting and shifting what is right for the people of my tribe and where I come from.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm learning about myself and I'm learning about what food means in that and how food heals and how we can shift the world around that. And that, like, sometimes when I hear myself say that, I'm like, that just sounds like really Californian. but it's in the context of, like, that if you really sit with yourself and know who you are and know what you want, all of these things will play out. And that's what, to me, that trip to Haiti did and is continuing to do for me.
You did mention some really interesting techniques of mm-hmm. people, especially in Haiti, I think probably in the Caribbean in general, where there's just not a lot of land to mm-hmm. have, like, livestock.
Mm-hmm.
Nose-to-tail cooking is not even, I'm sure, a phrase, because that's just cooking.
Right.
And you mentioned something with cow skin, with mm-hmm. the hide of beef. Mm-hmm. That was a technique I've never heard about before. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
Yeah. So when I was in La Tortilla, which is the island off of the coast of western Haiti that I went to, there was a sacrifice of a bull, and every part of that bull was consumed. And I'd never seen this before, where they took the hide, because I was like, oh, that hide's going to make a beautiful floor piece or whatever. Mm-hmm. No, it was dried out, and then it was rolled, and then it was cut really fine, and it was added to soup and made into a stew.
So just julienne cowhide.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And they burnt it to burn the hair off of it. And then it was rolled, and then it was cut, and it was put into a stew. They have just eaten this entire beast.
Yep.
In a way that I've never seen that. It was a marvelous moment to see people just taking this animal and making everything into a meal.
That's amazing.
That everybody, when they ate that, honored it before they ate it.
Yeah. You're nourishing and being nourished.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where that's coming from.
Yeah.
I think the pop culture sensationalism around Haitian voodoo and, mm-hmm. and that culture, and there's so much to unpack, and we're just going to be scratching around in the topsoil mm-hmm. if we try to dig too far into that. But
right.
One thing that I find really interesting is so much of it centers around animals
mm-hmm.
and whether you're capturing the beautiful, just purely spiritual side of feeding people and what a whole animal can bring to that.
Mm-hmm.
But it sounds like there's also just so much to do with plants,
yeah.
with herbs and vegetables and mm-hmm. fruits and foraging and making teas and all that
yeah.
sort of stuff. Can you talk a little bit about the relationship to plants within this community and this experience?
Yeah, for me, in La Tortie, I mean, they claim to have over 300 different types of mangoes. And we went hiking one day, and they were able to show me just the markings on the base of the tree of what made that mango different from the next mango.
Oh, wow.
You know, cassava, which you guys call yuca, breadfruit. I mean, everything was literally, if we wanted it, it was picked immediately and brought to the table.
Hmm.
And it's when people think of Haiti, they think of starvation, poverty. But I went to a place and I had never seen such plentiness or bountifulness mm-hmm. in the way that they honored food. You know what I mean? Everybody sat down in the morning and had breakfast.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody had lunch together.
Mm-hmm.
Food was blessed before it was eaten. This is a small island, like I said, off the coast of Haiti. We went swimming and there's clams at the bottom of the water. There's octopus. So everything is coming to you immediately.
Mm-hmm.
And so for me, that was just that was wealth in itself. Do you know
mm-hmm.
what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
The living in a small 4x4 room or whatever, sleeping on a mango leaf mat as a bed or whatever, all of that balanced out with the amount of love that was in food and tea, sour orange tea in the morning. Everything mm-hmm. had a purpose. Do you know
mm-hmm.
what I mean? Sour orange is consumed after spiritual Bembe is when it cleans the system out. Do you know
mm-hmm.
what I mean? So you've consumed all this rum when you're doing all this initiation work, and then the next morning you have sour orange tea because it cleanses and moves everything from your body. So everything has a purpose. Does that make sense?
Oh, totally.
Everything that is brought to you, consumed, is for a reason.
Yeah, I mean, not only does it make sense, but when we talk about travel to a new food culture or a new culture in general, it's always talking about what all these people do differently, wherever
mm-hmm.
you are.
Right.
And it's so interesting, this notion of foraging and
mm-hmm.
how fetishized that is right now
yeah.
in our world, in the chef community.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of so universal that it's not really even a thing.
Right.
There is just living in a place, knowing all the names of the plants.
And picking them.
And picking them. and have a feeling of...
It's called gardening.
Yeah. I like that. Sarah Kiernan, thanks for coming in and chatting with me.
Thanks for having me.
Sarah Kiernan is chef of Miss Ali's in Oakland, California. Ali Buzari is the author of Ingredient, Unveiling the Essential Elements of Food. The food writer Kushbu Shah has been reporting on the restaurant scene all over the country for years. I was in Chicago with her once, and we made plans to have breakfast, which ended up meaning a couple of tacos, then walking to a Mexican bakery she wanted to check out, before going to an ice cream place, and did I mention this was just breakfast? She puts in the work, people, and she is a great source for what's rad in restaurants these days, and where you should book a trip just to go eat. Kush, it is great to have you here.
Thanks for having me.
So, in all your travels across this great land, there is one possibly surprising town that you are kind of obsessed with.
Yeah, and that's Milwaukee.
Why? Tell me about Milwaukee.
Listen, I think the Midwest overall is super underrated. People, you know, don't appreciate the portion sizes, the incredible price points, and just like the incredible hospitality that comes out of there. Milwaukee just had a super surprising food scene. To be fair, I also went in sort of a little bit skeptical. I apologize to all of Wisconsin, but walked out shockingly excited about everything that's happening there right now.
So tell me, what is exciting?
So Wisconsin is sort of the land of dairy and meat and more dairy. And mm-hmm. Did I mention dairy? And Milwaukee has one of the best vegan food scenes in the country.
Really?
There's classic vegan restaurants like Celesta, which does vegan comfort food. Mm-hmm. And then places like Strange Town, which does sort of like the fussier, high-end, small plates, tapas style is like what they like to call it, mm-hmm. vegan things. But also if you just go to restaurants in the city, they without fail will sort of have a separate vegan menu available or like a whole slew of vegan dishes. I went to this amazing bar actually called Snack Boys, and you know, I got some really amazing braised cheese curds, which by the way is a genius dish, but they also
braised cheese curds.
Yeah, and like slow braised, almost like gnocchi in a tomato sauce.
Oh my God.
But then they also had a full separate vegan menu, which was like so unexpected. Just everywhere you went, there was several vegan options.
And it's not just, oh, we all have salads.
Yeah. It's not just like bland tofu. It's like really beautiful shaved mushroom salads and like sort of gorgeous sandwiches. Or like I had this really great Oaxacan inspired fried eggplant dish with like really great like black bean puree. You know, it was stuff that it's vegan, but it sort of doesn't matter if it's vegan or not. Yeah. You know, it's just good food at the end of the day.
Yeah. And speaking of what's underrated, I often feel like, oh, people don't realize how incredible the produce of the northern Midwest can be, like how flavorful the vegetables are and how deep the traditions of agriculture are beyond, like you said, dairy and cows.
There's so much farmland. And there's also the Great Lakes near Wisconsin and Michigan, and that has actually great seafood, especially coming out of Lake Michigan.
Yeah. So what else is rad about Milwaukee eating?
Definitely the fish fries is a Friday tradition.
Okay.
I think it started with Catholic immigrants who like don't eat meat on Fridays, and it became this really awesome cheap way to like feed your entire family. It's super affordable. Pretty much so many restaurants around the city, you know, do a fish fry on Fridays. You know, I had friends that ended up going to like a Latin inspired one or like a Puerto Rican inspired one, and like every sort of restaurant sort of adapted beyond the classic like deep fried fish fries. And maybe some other side like potato salad or like coleslaw or something to adapt to like whatever cuisine their restaurants are serving. It's really fun. I have yet to find a vegan one though, but maybe it's out there.
Fried algae is delicious. It actually probably is.
Honestly, fried I would eat kelp. Deep yeah, fried tofu though yeah. with some fries next to it. Sign me up.
And like anything like old school?
Oh yeah. There's this place called Three Brothers. It's sort of a little bit out of the way. It's in this building that's been around, I think, since the 1800s. It was like a former beer factory. But this restaurant has been around since 1956. And it serves like seriously old school Serbian classics. Milwaukee actually has a really big Serbian population, which I didn't realize until I got there. But you walk in, it's like Formica tables and everything is cash only. And like the receipt you get is just like scratch on like a piece of paper. So you have no idea if you are actually paying the correct amount for stuff. But it's like so wonderful and charming. And like the thing to get there is their burek, which takes like 90 minutes, I think, to bake. So like you can call ahead and be like, hey, I'm coming in. I really want like a cheese burek. And they'll like pop it in the oven for you. So that by the time you get there, it's almost ready to go. And if you don't know what a burek is, it's spelled a bunch of different ways on their menu, B-U-R-E-K. You can find it on the internet, I think, also as B-O-R-E-K. It's really popular in sort of Serbia, Bosnia, that sort of area. And it's this really gorgeous, layered, flaky phyllo dough pie situation with lots of butter, lots of cheese. Definitely not vegan friendly, but it's great. And then they have this whole selection of like old school Serbian like fruit brandies. And really great grape leaves. And everything is just, I don't know, service is really pleasant, but maybe like not too friendly. A little bit, you know, strict there, which is, I love it though. And, you know, it was started originally by three brothers, but I think now it's a couple generations in and it's actually two women in the family who run the kitchen, which is pretty cool to see.
Yeah. Right on.
Yeah.
Cool. Well, let's go together sometime.
Let's, please.
All right. Thanks for coming in, Kush.
Thanks for having me.
That was the writer Kushbu Shah, and for her list of her favorite places in Milwaukee, check out splendidtable.org. You can listen to all of our podcasts, find us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. And sign up for our weekly email, Weeknight Kitchen. It delivers a recipe straight to your inbox every Wednesday to make dinner time a little easier. Sign up at splendidtable.org. Stay safe, everyone. Thank you for tuning in. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is APM, American Public Media.
I'm Tanya Mosley. In 1987, my sister Anita vanished without a trace. Decades later, thanks to DNA, we found her. But that's only the beginning of the story. She Has a Name is a new audio documentary that explores the search for redemption, confronting trauma, and healing in the face of unimaginable loss. Subscribe now to Truth Be Told Presents She Has a Name, where every revelation brings us closer to the truth.